Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, a review of the book, Jesus and Paul. For many more resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
Well, before I look at what I prepared today, I wonder if any of you saw the Peter Jennings special on Jesus and Paul. With wry grins on their faces. I thought of, as I looked at this or watched this, I thought it started off really pretty good. You saw people on there like Ben Witherington and N.T. Wright, who were here at the Set Forth Your Case conference with us, as well as Paul Meyer, who was good, but then also a boatload of Jesus seminar types and so forth. And I actually thought that the part on Jesus was really pretty good. I thought it was balanced. It presented both the revisionist view, but then also the traditionalist view, and I thought it was well defended. But the longer the show went on, I thought the more it degenerated. And when they finally trotted out the Gospel of Thomas, I about threw up my hands at that point, because that is a forgery from the second century after Christ. It's not a primary source document. And the other thing that I thought struck me, and that some of you may have wondered about, was how do they know so much about Paul that they claim to know? Where did they get this information about what Paul really thought and these conflicts that he was involved in? Well, you know where they get all this, where all this information comes from? Well, the only source of information we have for Paul is this book, the New Testament. So, there isn't any other historical source about the life of Paul that sheds any additional information on his life other than what you and I read in the book of Acts and his letters in the New Testament. So all of this is really sort of just reading in between the lines of his own letters and the book of Acts. It's not as though these folks have some kind of additional historical information beyond what you and I have and that you and I can read in our New Testament, because this is really all we have. So I think it's well to keep that in mind when these folks present these rather revisionist and odd views of Paul based upon reading things in between the lines. Let me just say a couple of things. I was astonished when someone like Karen Armstrong, interviewed in the film, says that the Apostle Paul is not interested in doctrine. I about dropped my teeth when I heard that. I mean, this is the author of the book of Romans, right? He's not interested in Christian doctrine. He's written Galatians. Remember, this is a man who, when he writes to his churches, you can read his epistles, the first half of the epistle is always about doctrine. It's about Christian doctrine. Then the latter half of the epistles will be the practical application of that doctrine. So that claim is astonishing just at face value. One other thing that some of you may have wondered about that I think is just perhaps worth commenting on, and that is the statement over and over again in the film that Paul expected the return of Christ to occur within his own lifetime. And you may have wondered, well, why did they say that? Well, where does Paul say that in the New Testament? I can't find that any place in the New Testament that Paul says that he expects Christ to return during his lifetime. What Paul teaches is that the return of Christ is imminent in the sense that we should always be prepared, as Ben Witherington said. Always be prepared. We are living in the last days in the sense that this is the post-Pentecostal period. But how long it will be till Christ returns, Paul doesn't say. And in fact, we know that Paul was anticipating having future ministry at the end of the book of Romans. He talks about his plans to go on to Spain. Paul was not anticipating that this was all going to end soon. He was anticipating that he would go to Spain and do evangelism and missionary work in Spain. Well, we know he never made it because he was martyred first. He was executed. But Paul was planning for the future. Now, one additional thing that needs to be said about this, and that is this. Christian doctrine or biblical inerrancy concerns, as we saw, what the New Testament teaches. And even if Paul himself, say, had an anticipation that Christ would return in his lifetime, he doesn't teach that in the New Testament. So, to use an analogy, Paul probably believed that the sun goes around the earth. Living in a pre-Copernican age, Paul probably believed the sun goes around the earth. But Paul doesn't teach that the sun goes around the earth, you see? So, maybe Paul did believe that Christ would come back in his lifetime. I don't know. It's possible. He may have believed that, but he doesn't teach that. And so the teaching of the New Testament is that we are living in the last days, but we don't know how long that will last. Every generation needs to be prepared for the return of Christ. We always need to be ready to meet the Maker when he should return again. But I think that it was a non sequitur. It didn't follow from what Paul says in his letters, that what this film was saying about Paul was correct in that regard. Well, there are many other points that one might raise, but I want to hear if you had any reaction that you wanted to share, ask about. Yes, Cindy.
Obviously, from a less learned perspective, I was encouraged that I thought it was more balanced than prior Peter Jennings, even, or even prior other documentaries on the subject. And I was happy about that. I think there's pressure to present opposing views.
Yes.
And I thought, when I heard the reference to the Gospel of Thomas, I thought that they did say that that is a source that's not universally accepted as accurate. Mm-hmm. I thought they put some caveats around it that maybe at least put it in. They didn't say this is the Gospel of Thomas and it should be believed. I think they did sort of put some caveats.
Yeah.
That was just my only thought. I thought overall it was a pretty good.
Yeah. It certainly was an improvement over the In Search of Jesus that Jennings did a few years ago, wasn't it?
Exactly. And I did think that they did try to stick in some things repeatedly about the fact, like you said, that these disciples and Paul thought that Christ was returning immediately or in their lifetime and so forth. And by repeating that, I think that they were insinuating that everything they wrote was with that expectation.
Yeah.
And it kind of flavored what they were talking about, that maybe that's not as germane today as it was then because they thought.
Yeah. Casting a sort of pall over the whole of their doctrine because they were wrong about this or something.
That kind of thing bothered me. Yeah. Other things, but at least better.
Good. Okay, any other remarks? Yes.
One thing just stands out in my mind about it was that it seemed that they kept saying over several times, I think, that he was a mean or a harsh person.
Paul.
Uh-huh. Right? And that was, I think it said that a couple of times.
Yes.
He had conflict with Peter and all the...
And he even talked about his enemies being mad dogs or something. He's a leak. All right. And that also added to that plus the fact that what you were saying about him thinking Christ was going to return in his lifetime, that contributed to me that Paul was over the whole thing and make you not believe it was true.
Yeah.
Or believe against Paul.
Yeah. Well, you know, these claims, for example, that he was harsh, again, they're based on the writings of the New Testament that you can read yourself and you make up your own mind whether you think this guy was a harsh, mean sort of person. There's nothing here that is an additional source of historical information that you and I don't have and can't read ourselves and haven't been reading. He's thinking there of his letter to the Galatians, where Paul is so angry with these pseudo-apostles who are trying to get these Galatian Christians to go back under the law, that he says, I wish that those who want you to be circumcised would mutilate themselves, which is pretty harsh. I mean, he's really angry. But I think here, again, the film kind of distorted things a little bit in that it presented this business about circumcision as being Paul's attempt to say to the Gentiles, well, you don't have to undergo this uncomfortable operation. You know, it was basically sort of the pain of having this operation done on men that prompted Paul to say, well, this isn't really necessary. When circumcision was really just a sort of ritual symbol of a much deeper theological issue, and that was, do you need to go under all of the Jewish laws and regulations in order to be saved. And what Paul was saying is, you're saved by grace through faith. And if you wanted to be circumcised and so forth, that's fine. But you should not place that as a precondition for salvation, because he says then, read the letter to the Galatians, he says, you have fallen away from grace, you who would be under the law. And so that was why Paul was so concerned, while he was so upset, was that he understood that this was really a matter of the doctrine of salvation. Again, it shows the idea that he wasn't concerned with doctrine is absurd. He was concerned that those who would think that Jewish observances were necessary to salvation were replacing grace with law, and therefore, in effect, making salvation something that's earned by merit. So naturally, he is upset, and I think it's important as well in this connection not to equate Paul's opponents with James and Peter and John in Jerusalem. He says in Galatians, they gave me the right hand of fellowship, that I should go to the Gentiles and they'll go to the Jews, and we agreed, he says, on everything, so that these Judaizers that he was opposing were not Peter, James, and John. He goes back to Jerusalem near the end of his life when he's arrested. He's received there. The idea that there was this falling out between him and the mother church in Jerusalem, I think, is, again, it's a concoction of the critics based on the assumption that these Judaizers that Paul was opposing were representatives of Peter and John and James, which I don't think they were. Peter and John and James agreed with Paul and his Gentile mission, but it was these Judaizers that he opposed who were itinerant preachers that insisted on keeping the Jewish law in order to be saved. And that was what Paul opposed with the harshest of terms. Cindy?
I just want to mention that the way that the story or the program talked about circumcision or the fact that Paul was against it, that the reason he did that was to help add numbers to the church. And that really wasn't. Did you get that impression?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Okay, well, if you don't want to be circumcised, that's all right, because we want to grow the church. That wasn't the point at all,
yeah,
as you just said. And I think those are the kinds of impressions that were woven through it,
yeah,
that were speculations. And it was a speculation based not on historical study. It was... They just came up with this.
Yeah.
You see what
I hope you understand what she's saying. I think you're exactly right. That was the impression I got from the film as well, that to increase the number of converts, you get rid of this uncomfortable medical procedure.
And that it's okay to compromise.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? It was kind of like he was playing around with what was required,
yeah,
to become a new Christian.
Yeah.
That was...
Yeah, yeah. For anyone who really reads the letters of Paul and understands them, you know this was all about salvation by grace, unmerited grace of God. Yes, Clint?
I unfortunately missed the special. I meant to watch it, but how did they deal with the fact that he did require Timothy to be circumcised?
Yeah.
And the fact that he was the one who sought that first council in Jerusalem, which the problem was, is what do we do with Gentiles?
Right.
That, I mean, it was kind of the opposite now, but it's... We have all these Gentiles who want to become joined into the faith. What do we do?
Yeah.
And it seems like the issue was settled at that point.
Well, that's exactly right. What they said in the film, I wrote this down, they said that they had this Jerusalem meeting, but then they says the relationship was downhill from there. And I thought, where did they get that idea? You know, you don't get that from Galatians or from the book of Acts. When Paul takes the collection, you know, from all the Gentile churches to aid the mother church in Jerusalem because of the difficulty they're going through, and he comes back to Jerusalem and he's received with open arms, you know.
By the church.
Yeah, by the church.
But then you have the whole situation with the Jews who didn't believe.
Yeah.
That were rabble-rousers with him. But their complaint was that he teaches people not to obey the faith. And he says, well, I'm not doing that. You know, I'm paying for these people to have their upshear, their haircut, after their vows of Nazarene. He was taking them to the temple. So it seems very obvious that he's continued to keep the law, and he says as much. So I don't know why we keep viewing Paul as blowing away.
Yeah. It was, Flynn makes a good point. It was the non-Messianic Jews, or who didn't believe in Jesus, who were angry with Paul bringing a Gentile into the temple precincts. But in the film, it said the Jews and the Jewish Christians were the ones who got Paul arrested. And I thought, whoa, where did that come from? You know, that little detail was just gratuitous. That wasn't justified at all. Yeah, Colbert.
Yeah, I think that what I would like to see is a live panel where they get each person 10 minutes or 15 minutes in front of everybody so they don't cut people off in mid-sentence.
Yeah.
You know, because the editor is the one whose worldview is going to come
exactly, across. Exactly.
And people don't understand it. They just don't understand the way
yeah.
it works.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yes?
I just want to say I admire and respect you, Dr. Craig. I could not stay in your circle of friends because when the lady got on there, and I don't recall her name, and to me, I took it as she was kind of making Paul a poop and was saying, he wrote these things for his generation, and he was very, you know, hard-nosed, you do not do this and do not do that. And she said, he had no idea that 2,000 years later, people were going to be following these writings as if they were applying to our world. I had to quit watching it then.
Yeah, that was an interesting, I noticed that too. She said, Paul didn't think people would be reading these letters in churches. And I thought, what is she talking about? In Colossians, he says, see to it that you read the letter from Laodicea and, you know, have this letter read in their church. He expected these letters to be read aloud in the Christian congregations to which he wrote. So he may not have thought 2,000 years later, but he certainly did think he was writing authoritative doctrine. But, anyway, you can see in the same way that there's a battle for Jesus, there's also a battle for Paul that's going on now. And I think we're winning the battle for Jesus. I think that the presentation in this movie about Jesus was much more favorable, as Cindy said, than what we had before. Did you notice even Paula Fredrickson, who's one of the skeptics, saying about the resurrection, she says, all of the historical evidence attests to the disciples' conviction that they saw Jesus risen from the dead. I couldn't believe that Paula Fredrickson was saying that, you know. So that battle is going, I think, well. And as we continue to do good work, I think the battle for Paul should go well as well, because the letters are right there. Everybody can read them in the New Testament and form their own judgment. Let me just say one other thing, and I do want to then get to what I had prepared. Ben Witherington was also on the O'Reilly Factor Thursday night. And I said something to Ben about it afterwards, commented on it, and he wrote back he was very upset in this email. He said, I want nothing to do with those people ever again. He said, they told me before I went on I could not quote the Bible. I could not bring up anything theological. I could not bring up anything spiritual. All I could talk about was the political implications. He said, O'Reilly is either an ultra-left or lapsed Catholic who basically agrees with Crossan, John Dominic Crossan. And he said, wouldn't allow me to express my own views on these things. He said, I'll never go on a program like that again. He was really frosted about it. And so that I thought was interesting. And he said it's a shame that O'Reilly is regarded by so many conservative Christians as a kind of, you know, champion of the cause. I mean, he may politically say some of the right things, but on the religious level, Ben had a very, very different impression.
He's pro-homosexual rights.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the film on Jesus and Paul, couldn't resist either saying things about the pro-homosexual agenda and other things as well. You know, I noticed that they just couldn't resist getting in the political aspects of that. Well, okay. Yeah, Scotty.
Good, bad, or indifferent. You have to ask yourself, why did they make the production? And did it do a lot of good? Did a lot of people watch it and start asking questions and take a stronger interest in their beliefs?
I hope so.
Well, I mean, they do this for money.
Right.
They spend a lot of money to present something for an hour in hopes of making the money back. I'm kind of curious as to why they were motivated to do it.
Yeah. Peter Jennings, I think, has a real personal interest in these things. Peter Jennings, I think, has a real personal interest in these things to begin with. He did the special a few years ago in search of Jesus, and then now this one. So he obviously, I think, has a real personal interest. But obviously, ABC feels that it's going to gain viewers and that the sponsors will make money. And that's very encouraging. And I think we can be encouraged that this does arouse interest and arouse discussion. But it is frustrating when you see these misinformation being communicated, because it helps to mold our culture's view of Jesus and Paul and us, frankly, in ways that can be negative, I think. And that's unfortunate. But, well, I'm glad it's out there in the public square and being discussed. Yes?
I just was so happy to hear Bryant Wright today talk about the Da Vinci Code, because there's another example of a book. This is what, talk about getting so mad at, read this book at book club, and during the discussion, I just couldn't contain myself, and I had prayed that God would give me the right words to use, and I blew it, And I'm sure I came across as some Bible thumping, but it was just, what he said was so perfect, that this guy is putting out these myths and putting enough information that he says or claims is fact, that people that aren't educated, we owe it to ourselves to become more educated. They're actually believing that these are facts. And that was, I think, Brown's motive. I think that he really is trying to convert. Yes, it's fiction. He keeps coming back to that. But the way he weaves in historical figures and so forth, and it just makes me so angry that people are so gullible, and that we're being so misguided by things like that, which says to me, in fact, one of the members of my book club then gave me the Gnostic Gospels.
By Elaine Pagels?
I don't know who's the author, but I'm going to so study it and then so go back and point out the inerrancy of that and the Da Vinci Code, because they really have totally missed, they're being influenced, and the whole society is being influenced.
Yeah.
By this kind of garbage, and we Christians aren't educated enough to refute.
That's the tragedy.
We just lay down and let them talk, and I'm just going, oh, this is just, it just makes you want to, I don't know, there's a sense of anger, but then there's conviction.
Yes.
That we can't even speak up, because we're not grounded enough to be able to refute it.
Yeah.
That's the tragedy.
Well, and let that burning within you motivate you to study, to do it, because honestly, as I say, I think it will strengthen your faith. I really do, because it really is true that these folks are mistaken. They're in error about a lot of these things, and it will strengthen your faith, I think, to see that. Yes, there was a comment back there. I haven't seen that. Someone was just sharing that with me. What was your reaction?
I mean, I've read it, and actually I would have trouble with some parts, because I would sound kind of biblical, and so I have to ask my mom, and my mom read it, and she was like puffing the whole time she read it.
Yeah.
I was just wondering what you're thinking.
I'll have to look at it. Maybe I'll be able to say something next week, but I haven't seen it yet. One thing you need to be aware of is that half-truths are always the most dangerous, because you just distort the truth enough that it sounds plausible, it sounds reasonable, but if you just veer off the trajectory, then in time it can lead you to views that are just, light years apart. So that's where it requires subtlety and discernment. Yes, there was a...
I just want to make a quick comment about the frustration factor. I heard a sermon this week that really helped me, because sometimes I get frustrated in sharing with people and I feel like banging my head against the wall or banging their head against the wall. I heard a really neat sermon this week where the pastor was saying that, you know, if you saw a blind person who kept walking into the wall, you know, you wouldn't say, "What are you doing, blind man? You know, what's wrong with you?" You know, you would try to help him not bump into the wall again. And the fact is, these folks are blind. They are spiritually blind. And that really helped me to understand that I, in sharing with them, I can't get mad at them for bumping into the wall because they just can't see it. What I need to do is help them see it and share with them with some compassion. Conviction, but yet compassion at the same time.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just feel like throwing up your arms, your hands, and saying, "Forget about it."
Yeah.
That really helped me with the process.
Thank you. A couple of good resources here would be the book I referred to before, Jesus Under Fire, by J.P. Moreland and Michael Wilkins. Very, very fine collection of essays on a popular level. And then also a book by R.T. France, F-R-A-N-C-E, Richard France, called The Evidence for Jesus. A very balanced treatment of, you'd especially enjoy this, Cindy. He talks about the Gnostic Gospels and the Nag Hammadi documents and the Apocryphal Gospels and so forth. Very, very helpful book by Richard France. Called,
I saw a bumper sticker on the way in that just applies. It was on the back of a car in the parking lot. It says to the Dottie, it said, "Never underestimate the power of stupid people in large numbers."
Yeah.
I read the Da Vinci thing. I just thought, well, this is cute, but I'm terribly uneducated in the Bible's words and meanings, and yet it just seemed to me to be so novel.
Yeah, they do believe it. Well, I love the quotation that Bryant Wright put up where the girl says, "I didn't know about all these facts. I just had Indiana Jones for my source of information." Yeah, yeah. Now she's got the Da Vinci Code, you know, really. Yeah, a lot more torture. Okay.
Another area that seems to be under attack a lot is the early church history. Is the
mm-hmm.
church fathers.
Yeah, this is a good point. Yeah, I don't. Flynn is right. It's not just the biblical material that's also being criticized, but there are revisionist views of the early church, that is to say, the AD 200s and 300s and 400s, where it's claimed that what we call Orthodox Christianity is the group that just sort of happened to prevail, and history is always written by the winners. And that these other sectarian, Gnostic, and other weirdo groups were they had just as much a legitimate claim to be the true Christians and followers of Jesus as did the winning party. And that, you're definitely quite right about that, that is an issue that also needs to be joined by those who are interested in church history. But I couldn't give you a really good resource on that because that's not an area that I've been interested in and working in, but you're quite right that also is a battleground. Yes?
Bill, I can't help but pick up on this. A lot of good points being made here. And certainly I had the same impression as you in the beginning of that Peter Jennings series, that this is going to be worth watching. If I'm not mistaken, was that the same time that the Final Four was on?
Yeah, it was.
In college, I read a book entitled, I believe it was The Man Who Shook the World. And it was the almost a bibliography or a biography of Paul. It was fairly historically accurate, except they filled in the missing gaps with fiction.
Uh-huh.
And it was a great book. It was good reading, but it was a historical novel.
Yes.
It was not biblically and historically accurate. And I think this is the same thing to me that Peter Jennings is doing. Basically, he's in the entertainment business. People watch him and quite often take what he says as gospel. That series or that was written for entertainment, for ratings, for viewership. And to take something like that for gospel, as gospel, I think is dangerous. same thing with Oprah. So many people watch Oprah and accept what she does and what she says as the truth, the gospel according to Oprah.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody, I don't watch Oprah.
Yeah, no, yeah, I mean, at least in this case, in the Jennings case, he was interviewing bona fide scholars, and that's different than Oprah.
To be prepared to recognize where they are.
Yeah.
Venturing south or left, if you will.
Sure.
The truth, especially in
and the great thing about the Paul case, again, is that, as I say, we've got his letters in the New Testament. That's the only source of information that we've all got, and we can read them ourselves just as well as they can and draw our own inferences. So I'd encourage you to, you know, let this be a spur to deeper Bible study. Yes, Clint?
Yeah, it strikes me that the difference between, say, somebody who says Paul didn't want his, what didn't expect that his letters would be read in the church, you know, isn't that much different intellectually than somebody who is skeptical of, you know, institutionalized religion and thinks, yeah, maybe Mary Magdalene was Jesus' wife and it was just covered up by the church, you know, since it seems like they're both total fictions. Mm-hmm. But one's being offered by a scholar, other one's being offered by novelists.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that I keep remembering a saying that someone would say to me that's very helpful in my thinking. He'd say, when we'd be debating theology, he'd say, well, that's a good story, but how do you know it's true? And I think maybe when we talk about, well, like, you know, ignorant people or people thinking stupidly or something like that, it might help us as we share our faith, I think, or at least it helps me to remember that certain stories seem plausible to certain people for certain reasons. They may be totally fiction. You may be a scholar at a university claiming to do ecclesiastical history and be believing total bunk that has no merit. And you're really not much different than the woman who gets her history from Indiana Jones and from the Da Vinci.
Yeah.
But I think maybe what it might help us to do is if we run into people like this, is admit the plausibility. You know, well, that's a good story, but how do we know it's true?
Yeah.
And that's a lot harder to show.
Right, and that's using this Greg Kokel technique, isn't it, of asking questions. That's a great story. What evidence is there that it's the truth? And that puts it back on their shoulders. So I think that's an excellent point, Clint. Okay, well, obviously, I'm not going to get to my lesson today. So is there any other further comment or, yes? Yes, the one that I announced at the beginning of the class, this one you mean? Yes, I did. You weren't paying attention, Mary. Yeah, Colbert.
Are there any other scriptures? I found in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 where he's warning of that the people had thought that the rapture had already taken place, mm-hmm. and he said he was letting them know that the man of sin will be revealed first. Are there any other scriptures like that counteract or contradict what they were saying about Paul just believing that Jesus was going to return immediately? You know, in other words, that gives he knew that these things had to take place. The Holy Spirit gave him that the church would fall away first. Well, they were just building the church.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously it hadn't fallen away if they hadn't built it yet.
Yeah. The only one that I thought of was, as I say, his plans to do missionary work in Spain, which would be an enormous undertaking. It's at the other end of the Mediterranean. It would have been really a huge project that would have taken years. So that was the only one that I could think of. There may be others, but...
He writes the believer. I think it's in Thessalonians again. He writes there's a group of them that were no longer working and providing for themselves because they thought that the Lord would return at any moment. And he tells them to get back to work and provide for themselves and not to live off of the church.
Right.
You don't quit your day job.
Yeah,
right. I don't know if the rest of you heard that. He was saying the passage where Paul tells the Thessalonians who were thinking the Lord's return was imminent and so were quitting their jobs. And he said, no, don't quit. You continue to work. And you work, you know, right up till the end, whenever that would come. But it's interesting that Paul never makes it clear in his letters that he's saying this is going to happen before I die, or before you die, or something like that. He never says that. The truth that we're living in the end time means it's the final phase of God's salvation history, a post-Pentecostal phase, but that could go on a long time. And of course, in the Gospels, you have several parables of Jesus where Jesus talks about how the master is delayed in his coming, and so the people begin to party, and the virgins waiting for the bridegroom allow their lamps to go out because he's delayed. There are a number of parables where Jesus talks about the length of time, and therefore don't cease to be vigilant and so forth.
And Paul says, is it in Romans, where he says that in the last days they will mock, they will say, where is his coming?
Yeah, that's true. That's in Timothy. In Timothy. That would be another relevant passage. That's right, where he actually deals with that problem. All right, well, let's go ahead and conclude with a word of prayer, and then all of us, I suppose, will be going to our Easter dinners this noon. Thank you, Father, for this fellowship that you have given us, for this class and the bond of love and Christian fellowship that we share. We thank you especially, Father, for the Lord Jesus and his resurrection from the dead that gives us new life and hope for the future. And as we go from here, Father, we pray that you would guide us, that you would fill our day with blessings, thoughts of you, and thoughts of the great things that you've done on our behalf. We praise you with grateful hearts. In Christ's name, amen.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.